You open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
If the two people who are the combatants are ready to move on, then why do we harbor such feelings about this war, especially when we weren't even there?
Welcome to the National Writers Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Linnea Melkerick. Author Doug Stanton says we need to start talking honestly about Vietnam.
I think it's now time to have this national conversation about this war, because we don't want to pass away and we don't want to go quietly into that good night with never having put a period at the end of the sentence, which is, what happened to you in Vietnam?
National Writers Series co-founder Doug Stanton is the author of two best-selling nonfiction books, In Harm's Way, about the sinking of the USS Indianapolis, and Horse Soldiers, about a U.S. Special Forces team deployed to Afghanistan after 9/11. That book has been made into a movie called 12 Strong, coming out January 2018. Stanton's latest book is The Odyssey of Echo Company, the 1968 Tet Offensive, and the epic battle to survive the Vietnam War. He talks this hour with author and editor Colin Harrison, who edited Stanton's last two books. Harrison asked Stanton when he knew The Odyssey of Echo Company would become the next story he would tell.
You know, I actually thought of this book, Colin, in 2005 or 6 when I first met Stan Parker on a helicopter in Afghanistan. I was researching horse soldiers trying to go to the Pakistani border to a special forces camp, and the weather was poor. And Stan Parker and I kept going up and down in the Chinook, and he started telling me stories about Vietnam, and he'd read my World War II book. And I see In Harm's Way and The Odyssey of Echo Company as similar in that they're both survival stories. So I said to Stan Parker in 2005, I don't think so, Iraq and Afghanistan is among us. My editor and my agent probably would have a hard time selling that to their own peers. And in fact, when I returned, I talked with Sloan Harris, our mutual friend and my agent, and it wasn't the time. But I felt, growing up in Traverse City, Michigan, I remembered, so this is a generation and a half ahead of me, and I felt the discontent on the street. And I always remember the body count on the television screen. So part of the book is a journey for me to understand what was happening at large in the nation. And I don't know why we're, I don't know, I think now something is changing. And when Tom Brokaw first helped out with In Harm's Way, I spoke with him and he said, I met those guys when they turned 70, the World War II generation, and the American male, I think, doesn't open up until he reaches about 70. There's a sense.
So we have a ways to go here.
Yeah. Yeah. That happened with those guys, and now they're 95. Mm. And so if you are between 65 and, say, 75, you're thinking about Vietnam. And you may now be thinking about just what the hell it meant. And so there's that. So they're becoming our elder veterans, the bearers of, you know, America's really most calamitous social event around the 60s. And also, it's the 50th anniversary of everything. So that's... that's the outer machinery of the book. I think what you're asking is, how did the story grab hold of me? How did I know that I had one? And it was when I met Stan in 2011 in Colorado Springs at his home, at his kitchen table, and he began to tell me the story which opens the book. And he started to cry. And whenever I am in the presence of, you know, you're in the presence of something so deep, there's a story there. But whether you can untangle it is another matter.
Right.
Which is where you kind of then came in later down the road. But
well, let's talk about that. So you've had that that moment of emotional transaction where you've looked into Stan's eyes and you know in your heart and in your brain, I am going to write this man's story. And so doing, you're going to write the story of the men he went to war with, the story of America at the time, a lot of things. But it all begins with Stan. How did you then set about to report the book, compile the book, elicit the book, dream the book? Books very infrequently just present themselves easily to the writer. You have to kind of pull it out of the universe.
Right.
And how did that happen?
Slowly. I do a lot of reporting, and Ann Stanton helps me a great deal in this. And for me, if you had seen my dining room wall this summer, it would have looked like one of those National Geographic specials on underwater kelp beds, you know, when the divers swim, because all the pages of the novel had been taped together, and then I hung them on the wall, and the breeze would move them, and I would stand back and look at the book. Which is because a book is a finite thing, and you lose sight of that when you're writing it. It actually has a beginning, middle, and end, and it's physical, and you need to actually be larger than the book in some ways to finish it. You need to stand up on your hind legs and kind of stare it in the eye, because it can dominate your own psyche. I was attracted to Stan's voice. When I met him in the helicopter, he sounded like the character Gus in Lonesome Dove. And the book is really inflected with a lot of his tonal qualities. My MO is probably to really try to absorb the point of view and inhabit the consciousness of the person I'm writing about. And I just do that by phone calls and reporting and texts and re-reporting. It's voluminous. I have 36 inches of drafts of the book at home in a tub this high. And it all became this. And I have probably 5,000 pages of interviews. But you know, only a fraction of it becomes the book. You didn't see hardly all of that, or nearly all of it.
A pity.
A pity, yeah. No, it would have. Yeah. Oh, I tried to send it, but no.
Well, let me just interject there, because as your editor, of course, I'm privy to the process. And one of the things that was clear to me as you struggled, is not too strong a word, struggled to compile and order and sequence and prioritize material, was that there were certain passages that were so powerful that you kind of took a running start at them a couple of times, and that you kept working on them, and they were so enormous psychically that you had to kind of take yourself into a place to get them written. And I'm thinking about the girl with the peaches in particular. And talk a little bit about that, because it's a tremendous psychological task to inhabit the mind of a man who was at the time a boy and undergoing tremendous trauma, and yet make it work for the reader.
Yeah, it's a dark place. I had a background in theater or acting a bit, and I don't know, that doesn't mean I am acting here, but I'm trying to really be a witness for their psyche. Just, you know, and I think for those of you who were alive during Vietnam and may have your own feelings about this, you may feel the same way, that when you came home from Vietnam or your family members came home from Vietnam, what was most missing in their lives was the sense of witness, acknowledgement. So you have the most transformative thing that's ever happened to you in your life, if you're of that age, and you come home and you basically bury it. And you're told that you cannot remember or repeat that thing that happened to you, because first the country doesn't want to hear it, and you don't know how to talk about it. And so the book, and that's what I like. I like to write about people who are trying to make hard decisions at the least opportune moment. And war provides these existential moments where you can peer into someone's soul. And so to do that, though, it requires a great deal of empathy and understanding. And it's made me, I think, a different person, not a better person, but a different person, to try to learn how to just be empathic to people and just listen without judgment and see what's on the around the next corner. And we don't have that enough today. And we have that with, you know, if you want to look at large in our society, we're missing a lot of that. We're reacting all the time and not listening. And as these guys do get older and the families of that generation do get older, I think it's now to time this have this national conversation about this war. Because we don't want to pass away and we don't want to go quietly into that good night with never having put a period at the end of the sentence, which is, what happened to you in Vietnam? And so, yeah.
And one of the things that happened to you while you were writing the book was that although Stan was forthcoming and willing to talk, although I'm sure you had to pull some things out of him, you also had to go after some of the other members of the platoon who were a little more elusive than Stan, and that was not easy.
Right. It was an eye-opener to work on a bit of history which the participants of did not want to speak about. Now, just think about that for a moment. That is a dysfunctional outcome of our society, and we have to get beyond that. But however, to do that, when I'm on the phone, sometimes some of the guys in this platoon, this reconnaissance platoon of the 101st Airborne, would have a very emotional time with me on the phone, and so I would just listen and then not maybe call them again, because it wasn't right. It wasn't the right time. But what I'm hoping that the book is, as with In Harm's Way, it becomes something that slid across the kitchen table. And if you've been in that war, or, you know, I was talking to I was downstate doing an interview, and the woman interviewing me was about 30, and she said, oh, my grandfather was there. I'm going to read this, and I'm going to give it to him, and maybe he'll start talking with me. And so you use the book as a node or as an excuse to ask questions. And hopefully by walking a mile in Stan Parker's shoes through this experience, there is some sense of closure, which we don't get a lot with Vietnam these days, but Stan Parker does, I think.
I think one of the not just compelling, but transcendental aspects of the book is that you go back into Stan's boyhood, and we are able to watch Stan, the boy, the young boy, become a young man, and then a young man who enlists to go to Vietnam and then becomes a man in full, to steal a phrase, at war. And that's not a bad lead in to perhaps reading a couple of passages.
Sure.
Such as the first one that we've talked about.
Yeah. Ultimately, this book is also about parenting. And when you read it, you'll see why. And Colin was urging me to go deeper into Stan's childhood, because it actually begins when he's about six. The book, Stan's life happens around the war, and it really follows Stan's trajectory into present day. And his childhood was so amazing. He was the son of an iron worker in Gary, Indiana, and he lived in 40-some states by the time he graduated from high school. And so he knew the world, and he actually knew his way around the world. And he had a very loving family. Parents loved him, and he had brothers. And it was a happy childhood, seen from the back of a big pickup truck window as they moved around from city to city, and his father built bridges and skyscrapers. I'm convinced that helped Stan Parker stay alive later, because he knew his way around a room and how to work it. And part of the thing I'm talking about being empathic is listening to Stan's innocence and not trying to be ironic or sarcastic about it. Because some people really are that way. And
now, before you read this, I just want to say that when I first read this scene, I sort of slapped my head and I said, oh my God, did this actually happen? It just seems impossibly sweet and naive and lovely, and it captures a lost America. So, get to it.
His mother has died, whom he loves a great deal. and whose heart he broke by secretly enlisting in the army. So the guys you read about in this book actually volunteered for this, and they're the sons of World War II, and his father was a bomber in World War II. And World War II had ended only 23 years earlier. 23. We're 17 on from 9/11. So you can see how the World War II had imbued the family dinner table with a sense that enlisting again was the right thing to do for this group of Americans, while at the same time, of course, other people are not enlisting. So for whatever reason, Stan Parker does, and his mother dies, and he's home on leave, and he's in Texas at her family.
Just tell us the year.
1966. And they're at the family homestead and making funeral arrangements. When his father explains that their mother will be buried on November 20th, Stan realizes he has a problem. He's supposed to return to Fort Huachuca that very day. In order to attend the funeral, I have to extend his leave. He phones his company commanding officer in Arizona, expecting to fix this problem quickly. The CEO doesn't take long to think it over. No, he says, most emphatically, and if you're not back here, Parker, you're AWOL. So your ass will be grass, and I'll be the lawnmower. Well, that's clever, Stan thinks. He pleads for more time, believing that reason will win here, but it's no use. He's denied. He tries thinking the problem through, believing that no matter the circumstance, there's a solution. He walks into the living room, its oak floor covered with a braided rug, its walls bearing pictures of generations of Parkers, and sits down next to his father, who Stan thinks has suddenly begun to look older. A news story on TV catches Stan's eye. The report is that President Lyndon Johnson will be at his Texas ranch for the Thanksgiving holiday. Stan has an idea, a crazy one, he thinks, but what does he have to lose? He picks up the phone in the hallway and dials the operator on the local party line. The operator's name is Sarah, and the Parker family has known her as long as Stan can remember. The party line connects the Parker household to all other houses in Queen City, Texas, and to the rest of the world. "Why, Stan Parker," says Sarah, hearing Stan's voice. "How are you?" "I'm fine, Sarah. I'm in Queen City. I'm sorry to hear about your mother." "That's kind of why I'm calling," Stan says. Sarah asks him what he means. "Well, I have a strange request, Sarah. My company commander won't let me stay in Texas for the funeral, and I need to be here for my dad." "You're kidding me. They won't let you stay?" "No, ma'am. And I saw on TV news that the president's in Texas, and I'm in Texas, and well, I thought I might talk to him." The LBJ Ranch in Johnson City sits about 400 miles southwest near Austin. Sarah says she doesn't see why she can't at least try to connect him. "You don't go anywhere. I'll be right back." Several minutes later, the phone rings. "Stan," Sarah says, "you're on with the LBJ Ranch in Johnson City." Stan pauses. "Is this really working?" A man on the other end asks him what he can do for him. Stan stumbles a bit, then says, "Hi, yes, this is Private Stan Parker of the U.S. Army. May I please speak with the president?" The voice at the other end seems amused. Stan will later discover he's a military aide. "Perhaps I can help you," he says. "Tell me what you'd like to discuss." Stan explains how his mother has died and that he'd broken her heart when he, Stan, had signed up for the Army after high school graduation, and now he wants to give her a proper funeral, but his company commander back in Fort Huachuca has forbidden him the time. There's a silence on the other end of the phone. Stan figures the person is absorbing this news. "And everything you're telling me is true, is that correct?" "Yes, sir, it is." "Okay, you stay on this line. Sarah," the aide says, "I'm going to give you a number, it's enlisted, and I want you to tell them that this call has been directed from the LBJ Ranch." "Yes, sir, thank you. Now, Private Parker, do not hang up." "No, sir, I won't." The aide hangs up and Sarah dials the number saying, Stanley, I'm connecting you now." After a few rings, a woman's voice is on the line. Sarah says, "Yes, this call has been referred to you by the LBJ Ranch in Johnson City, Texas." Almost immediately, a male voice picks up. "This is Robert McNamara speaking. How can I help you?" Stan is floored. He's talking with the Secretary of Defense of the United States of America. He presses on with his story about his mother's funeral. Mr. McNamara listens and seems to express shock at the company commander's refusal to extend Stan's leave. He tells Stan that he'll take care of things. As unexpectedly as it began, the phone call ends. The secretary remains true to his promise. The following day, when Stan calls for Huachuca again, he learns his leave has been extended. He also learns that the U.S. military will pay for his return flight and even provide a military escort from Chicago to Fort Huachuca. Upon arriving at the base, his escort, an Army colonel, strides crisply into the CO's office, who looks up in surprise. "I've been sent by the Secretary of Defense to bring Private Stan Parker back to your command. He's been at his mother's funeral, and he is, I repeat, not AWOL." The CO turns completely white. Stan thinks the man is going to have a stroke. The colonel says goodbye and strides out the door. Stan considers saying something clever, but thinks better of it. He simply salutes and hustles from the office. This, he thinks, is how you survive in the Army. Be bold, act swiftly, and keep moving.
I'm going to lead into the next one a little bit. So that's a fantastic passage in and of itself. And in a nutshell, it gives you Stan, he's 18 at that point, his belief system, his innocence, his sort of intrepid courage to do such a thing. But it also establishes a baseline for the reader, and we're going to go somewhere else now, and we're going to go to war, and Stan is going to be taken to a very far place. And I think that's the next
part. Part of it is, you know, he was the person who believed that if you had a problem and you could call the president would fix it. If you could reach the president. Now, that to me is a beautiful thought, right? We all kind of have it. The rupture in Stan's life and many people and many veterans is that they then end up fighting in that same president's war. And they realize that what they had felt about that sense of care or hope is lost. And, you know, part of the book is about, the book ends with a question, who's watching? In a section that Colin suggested, I titled The Invocation. I was going to call it prologue, but I've done that 3 times. And he said, no, you're invoking something here. It's almost like you're trying to summon the story up out of something. So we titled it Invocation. But it ends, but Stan is, I won't read that passage, but he's in a battle and he wonders who the hell is watching, right? Who's watching this? In other words, why is this happening to me? Who's the author of this moment? And maybe there is no one watching. And the book ends with, and that was a brilliant move by Colin to suggest that I end the book in that same, posing that same question. So throughout, the book is really about what relationship do we have to each other, not just in war, but to watch out for you, to make those decisions, which are the right decisions that for all of us. So that's
Well, the passage you're going to read, I won't give it anything away by saying that at this point he's traveled far beyond an understanding of causation, sequentiality, and logic, and he's in another place.
Right. So this section is called The Girl with the Peaches. And we debated a lot whether or not to leave the preposition in or out. Should it be The Girl with Peaches or The Girl with the Peaches? And I know it's a funny title for a book about Vietnam, but you'll see why it's relevant. It's now 1968, it's February. You've just seen him in 66, November. So what is this, 2 years later? You've met him when he's six. He's been in the country since mid-December. The Tet Offensive kicks off January 30th, 1968. Some 100,000 enemy troops attack multiple cities throughout South Vietnam. It's some of the worst fighting in the war. In 1968, over 16,000 Americans were killed. There are 500,000 American soldiers fighting in the war. It is really a peak. And so this young man who thought you could call the president and fix your problem about your mother's funeral is now in the middle of this war. And this to me was the turning point in the book. When I wrote this, Colin, I kind of figured out maybe what the book is about. And all right.
But this section also tormented you too as a writer because you wanted to get it right. I have to say that.
Yeah. They've been out in the field. They don't have food or water or tent. Stan's girlfriends would write him and say, tell me, is it like camping? Do you sleep in a tent? And they would pass around the letters from the girlfriends and keep them sealed in plastic bags because they were perfumed. And around a campfire, they would, not a campfire, but around the gunfire, they would, they'd pass these plastic bags around and it's just to inhale the fume of the letter. And Stan and his buddy would walk around saying, you know, Riley, back now in the US, there are women standing on the street corner about to go shopping and they don't know we're here. Do you even remember what a girl looks like? And then Stan would, he carried three pictures, one of whom of a woman he eventually married and is married to today. And they would sit there and Riley would say, you still got those pictures? And Stan said, yeah, I got them. And he carried them over his heart in case he got shot in the heart, it would be the last thing that his heart would feel would be those pictures entering it. And Riley said, do you mind if I look at them? And so, no, I don't mind, Riley. So he'd take him out and Riley, he'd lay back in the bank and Riley would just hold him up sky and just look at him and just start to talk to the picture. And then, okay, thanks. You won't ever tell him I did this, will you? No, I won't. And put it back. And it was that kind of watching which so informed their experience and bonded them together so closely. They're watching out for each other there, providing a, kind of a parallel universe to the ugliness. And this scene is about that ugliness. Stan is walking in a gray drizzle with Al Dove and Brian Riley, wrapped mummy style in clear plastic shower curtains they've torn down from the shower stalls at the nearby schoolhouse. The curtains are their only protection from the cold rain. Their weapons poke through a part in the curtains and they make a strange sight like translucent beasts. Stan sees a little girl standing in the middle of the road up ahead, watching the groups advance. She looks scared, filthy, and very alone. As he gets closer, he sees that she's also very young, maybe 6 or 7. Her hair is tangled and her face is dirty and streaked with tears. Stan takes off his shower curtain and offers it to her. She doesn't move, so he wraps it around her, but it's too long and bunches around her bare feet. So Stan takes his K-bar knife and hacks away at the extra length to shorten it. She doesn't say anything. She does not ask for anything, nor does she stand back and shy away. She stands there looking at him, mute, impassive, courageous. Stan feels the need to do something for her, but he simply stares at her in his confused, sleep-deprived state. He looks and looks at her, and then he has what he can only describe as an epiphany, an awakening, as if his eyes are snapping open after a long nap. He is able to see the whole lousy war through her eyes, the shooting, the killing. Images roll back and forth over her face, and he watches them pass before them, a movie of who he is, who he was, and who he's becoming, an animal, a killer, a young man who is filled with hatred, as President Johnson had predicted all young men would become in the jaws of war. He has this overwhelming desire to make the girl safe, but he doesn't know how. He wants to give her something, clean clothes, food, a future. He has nothing to give her except his attention. Then he remembers he has a can of peaches in the canvas bag on his chest where he stores his claymore mines. He pulls out a heavy can of the fruit and bends to offer it to her. The can is large in her dirty hand, which sags under its weight. "It's okay," he tells her. "Go away now," and makes a shooing gesture with his hand. He would like someone to come and take care of her. He would like to come back to Vietnam as another kind of person and be able to offer her some peace and attention and safety. It's quiet between the two of them, punctuated by the rustle of the shower curtain wrapped around her thin shoulders. She stares at the can of peaches and then back at Stan, as if asking him what she should do with this. It's then he realizes he's been left behind by the rest of the patrol. He knows they're in a no man's land where he could run into any number of enemy, and he feels terribly exposed. Al Dove and Brian Riley, already far ahead, are calling out to him, "Come on, man, we've got to get out of here." He finally turns from the girl and touches her gently on the head and says, "Goodbye," and runs to catch up. He rounds a corner and sees the other guys up ahead. A few seconds after that, he hears gunshots behind him. "Not the girl," he thinks. He wheels around and runs, his gear flapping around his body as his arms pump faster and faster. He turns the corner and there she is, a tiny clump, no bigger than a pile of rags in the street. Looking down the road, he sees four MVA soldiers fleeing among the buildings. He levels his weapon and fires at them, but he misses and curses himself. How could he miss when he'd killed so many men before? Stan runs up to the girl, looks at her, and drops to his knees, crying. Why, oh, why, oh, why, he wonders. He knows why. Because he's a bad person. Because he's an American soldier. Because he's a man filled with madness. He looks down at her, still holding the peaches, her hand tightened in spasm around the can. Her fingers are incredibly slender and tiny. Why did he give her the can of peaches? He would love more than anything to reach back through time and take them back. She's dead because she accepted the American's peaches. The irony is, if he'd had no compassion for her, if he'd ignored her, she'd still be alive. He might as well have aimed his rifle at her and pulled the trigger himself. Stan looks up at the sky, shuddering, and he starts howling, a hoarse cry, emptying from his stomach, more animal than human. The rest of the guys come running back to him, and they stop when they see him. They're unsure what to do. They look at him and start circling as he rocks back and forth in the street. Brian Riley finally walks up and says, "Hey, man, we have to get out of here again." Looking around for the return of the NVA, "Let's radio this in and go." Riley then calls in the sighting of the four soldiers so that the others in the battalion can be on the lookout. Stan reaches over and picks up the little girl and cradles her. She's warm, her chest is soaked with blood. He thankfully figures that she died instantly. He walks with her in his arms across the street to an empty building. It's been bombed and reduced to rubble, but the front wall is standing, and he thinks that she'll be safe there, away from the street. Next door is an apartment building that's been bombed and empty too. Dove and Riley want to leave, but Stan refuses. He tells them that he will not leave the girl there alone. He tells them he wants to sit across the street in the safety of another building, a hidey hole, and wait to see who comes passing by. Maybe the bastards who shot her, or some of their friends, or maybe her family, or someone who knows her. But either way, he can't leave her like this in an empty building alongside an empty road as twilight falls now. The other guys try to convince him, but Stan won't leave. He sets up an ambush position across the road with his M16 trained on the building where she lies in state. Through the long, cold night, he thinks he hears footfalls in the dark and the steps of the approaching enemy, but nothing happens, and as sun rises, he gets up feeling sore and stretches. He has that feeling worn out, rinsed out after great strain, as if the terror of the past days had burned away his nerve endings. Across the road, he sees the rats. They're crawling all over the girl. He can hear their scratching, and he puts it all together. Oh God, no, he thinks. Real calm, he lifts his M16 against his cheek, takes aim, and fires. One of the rats goes flying backward away from the girl, and he aims again and fires again. Another rat cartwheels away. Stan thinks the report of the carbine would have scattered the rats, but they are persistent. He starts firing more rapidly, knocking them down. He keeps firing even after the last rat is dead, getting more excited now, feeling his nerve endings coming back to life as if sprouting through his skin. He keeps pumping rounds into the dead rat bodies. He shot them all, everyone, at least several dozen, and he says over his shoulder to Riley, calm and spooky, "More ammo." And Riley, without objecting, hands him another magazine, 19 more bullets, and Stam jams the mag up in the receiver and charges the weapon and begins firing some more. He fires several more magazines, then stop, and it's quiet, real quiet. Dove and Riley tell him, "It's okay, you did good." Stan realizes he's gone berserk. After a few moments, he gets up, walks across the road to the girl and looks at her. He can barely stand looking at her, the ugly thing he's wrought by his attempt at kindness. He realizes for a second time he's let her down. He screams. So follow that, Colin.
Okay, well,
you know, otherwise it's a musical comedy. Yeah. So,
well, if we go back to my original question of how Doug, the writer, conjures the story, not just from himself, but from his subject, and then renders it, you begin to see that it's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to write that passage. We're all affected by it. I've read it many times, and I'm still affected by it. And it takes quite an effort for a writer to do that. And it also is a tribute to Stan that he let that part of his life come out and into the book.
Stan Parker and the members of the Recon Platoon were brave for two times. First, for having survived this ordeal. And there are other men in the book as well. And in some ways, unfortunately, Stan's story has to stand for the many. And there are many more stories out there equally worthy of telling. And brave also then, secondly, for talking to me. Let's just think for a moment, would we have the courage to tell that kind of story about ourselves? I don't know. It took a special person. It took a person to be in the helicopter in Afghanistan to pull me aside to ask me to write this story. And that's a difficult passage to read because it troubles Stan to this day. And that is the national tragedy. Stan is not alone, and there is so many of these stories out there. You know, we've talked about this. And how are they going to come out?
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up, Doug Stanton talks more about his latest book, The Odyssey of Echo Company.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Colin Harrison.
As the editor of the book, when I realized that Stan had found or encountered the Vietnamese soldier who had tried to kill him, and that they'd had this remarkable moment together, I knew that the book had a perfect arc. And when you were in the helicopter originally with Stan in Afghanistan, that hadn't happened yet. You didn't know that that was going to happen. You didn't know that that was possible. And yet it did happen, and it was real, it was true, it wasn't scripted. That must have been a moment for you when the book lifted off and became something else.
Right. The book's called Odyssey for a reason. In some ways, it's about the homecoming they had, and it reenacts or creates the homecoming I think that Stan wished he'd had, which is actually, he also said, "I'm having more fun here coming home than I ever had in the U.S. Which raises the question, if Mr. Sin, who lives in that small village. We don't have a village that small around us here. He'd heard that there were some Americans. He walked down the road, and we found him, and we had our picnic together. And they were wary of each other at first, but once they realized they were both telling the same story and had met each other, you saw the act of forgiveness upon both of them. And they don't speak any common language. It raises the question, why can't we? Right, if the two people who are the combatants are ready to move on, then why do we harbor such feelings about this war? Especially when we weren't even there. My job as the writer is to try to put you in that war and to make you identify and feel some of the suffering and the poignancy and the joy of that experience. I knew that I wanted that sense of catharsis with the book, but I didn't know where it would end. You're exactly right. And I actually, at the moment, that moment was so bizarre and quiet. It was so quiet on this dirt track with the shade of trees, and it didn't seem like the end of the book. I didn't know what was happening. Tony was there, and he was photographing it. And the whole journey was a matter of epiphanies for Stan, and this was another one of those epiphanies. Our tour van, we were on a tour, we were just in a van, and we had a really wonderful guide. It rolled to a stop, and since Stan had been in the Army so long, he was pretty sure that this is where he'd been shot. And he didn't even wait for the van to stop. The door rolled open, he stepped out two steps, stepped over the brush, and then he froze in this small, sparsely grass area, which was a dry rice paddy. And I stepped through the brush and next to him, and he was having a flashback. And I put my hand on his shoulder, and he goes, I'm here. And I said, where? And he goes, I'm here, this is where it happened. He had just happened to step out at the very spot where he'd been hit with a grenade and other gunfire. That was serendipity of a certain kind. And then all the gears and the pieces of the puzzle, and then when Mr. Sin walked down the road, everything snapped back into focus for him, and the sense of disconnect in his life was dissolving, and there was a sense of order now replacing that sense because he was remembering and thinking of things. It was almost as if he had that author back in his life who was telling him, this happened, then that happened, and I guess I wrote that scene early, but I thought it might be the end of the book, but it was, the scene like the girl with the rats, and there's other stuff that, it was hard to untangle my own emotions, and you, with the pencil, were helpful in guiding that,
So. I like to tell writers, chronology is your friend, because it helps you get the book written. That being said, there are places in the book where you go back into Stan's childhood in an opportune moment, and we see that boy, which every time I see that photograph, I'm staggered by the innocence and beauty of that child.
The one picture of him kind of, after he'd enlisted, he's got a Calumet High shirt on. That's 66. He didn't look much different in December of 67. And then that picture where he has the 1,000-yard stare, that's only after 8 weeks in the country.
So. These photographs came to us, in many cases, they were original printed photographs, and some of them were the old Kodachrome, smaller format photographs. And we spread them all out on a conference room table, and we're just gobsmacked by their power. And the book has a lot of fabulous photographs in it, taken by Stan for the most part, which gives you the story.
Did you want to do the Dwight Lane deal?
I wanted to do the Dwight Lane deal.
I'd like to do the Dwight Lane
deal. I got that. Yeah.
The reason I want to do it is that, we're talking about time.
Right.
And I think I think one of the things we can give each other is a sense of order in time, and chronology is our friend. And one of the things I was aware of when Stan's having this moment in 2014, and he's back in 68, that you're literally flashing back between dimensions. And that's a very difficult thing to deal with for any veteran, for any of us. And a lot of these maladies we're talking about are true today of other people you may have, you may know, coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan. So since a book is written, since language only works one word at a time in a sense of time, it's hard. It's not like painting. The writer is always challenged to figure out how to communicate time shifts. And Colin and the publishing house, Scribner, were kind enough to let me do some things with present tense, which I don't normally do.
Let me just add one more thing before you read this section, is that although the book belongs, in a sense, to Stan, we do get to know some of the other men who fight with him. And after the war, the question naturally arises, what happened to them? And can we glimpse them? And I would say in some ways this was some of the most difficult reporting. Isn't that fair to say? That just finding them in time after the Vietnam War. And luckily you were able to get this.
Yeah, we drove down to Dwight Lane's house in Indiana, and doesn't use text or internet, so everything with Dwight is on the phone. And so I've both visited and called him a lot. And I was just struck, this scene in particular is about that shepherding that Dwight is doing in the memory of a fellow named Charlie Pyle. In this book, a guy named Charlie Pyle is killed at one point, and many of the platoon would mark time by saying, this happened after Charlie died, or this happened before Charlie died. And so it became a touchstone, but yet when Charlie left deceased, they really never thought of him again. They had a habit of not learning first names, but only last names, and because it was one more thing to forget. But in this case, Dwight Lane can't forget. And this is what he does in homage. So this section's called Wandering, and now the men are coming home after their tour. The Tet is over. When Dwight Lane comes home to Woodville, Indiana from the war, he hitchhikes the last few miles to his family's farmhouse. His mom, Verniel, and dad, Earl, are still at work. His mom is a housekeeper, and Earl operates the sewage plant at the nearby state mental hospital, and the house is empty. It's snowing when the last car drops him off. How does a man come home? When you have seen terrible things, shot, killed, maimed, quivered, and quaked at the moment of truth, with the shells coming in, how do you come home from this? Dwight stands at one of those old picture windows, single pane, thick, like the glass of an aquarium, and as he stands close to it, he can feel the winter coolness seeping through from the other side. He looks at the cornfield out the window with the snow falling and the cut-off yellow corn stalks holding a dusting of dry snow on their cut tops, about the diameter of sawed-off leg bones, hundreds of them lined in rows, knee-high, their tops mounded with snow. The bones go on, row after row. Dwight is tired and sunburned, and the house is so quiet and so empty of anything, but especially the guys. The guys, where are the guys? He is sure he is about to crawl out of his skin. He tries to make sense of Charlie Pyle's death and discovers, as far as he can tell, that there isn't any. It happened. Charlie died. This is the best he can come up with. Dwight had joined the army to escape Indiana and see the world. Growing up, he often wondered about the scars his father had gotten in World War II, which the old man never talked about. It will be years on his father's deathbed, in fact, before his father would tell Dwight what he thinks of that war, marching across Europe, the bodies that will spring up in his field of vision years later, back in Indiana, when he's just idling along in his life, trying to be Dwight Lane's father, and sometimes failing and sometimes succeeding. But Dwight, if he'd been able, as he knelt in the rice paddy with Charlie Pyle in his arms, Dwight would have chosen with all of his might at that moment to slide forward in time and come to rest at his father's deathbed, and he would have bent close to his father's lips and listened as the old man explained how to understand the death of Charlie Pyle. What would his father have told him, he wonders? Accept it? Move on? Accept death? He doesn't know what his father would have said, and he knows that he never will. The truth is, the platoon loved Pyle in those moments when he was with them alive and then he was gone. Afterward, after the war, they never looked for his family, for his friends. They never looked for any sign of him. They remember him, though. They never forget him. No one looks for Pyle, that is, except for Dwight. Each year when March 22nd rolls around, the anniversary of Pyle's death, he's antsy, irritable. A certain malaise comes over him, as the world does not seem a right place to live in. Each year is the same. His friends notice his mood change, coming on strong like the change of seasons, always coinciding with spring. As an older man, he lives alone in a nice house filled with cigarette smoke and Clive Cussler paperbacks spread on the kitchen table. The house never quiet because of the TV in the next room, a house by the side of the road. There's Dwight, sitting at the kitchen table and looking out at the sunlight of the spring day every year until finally in 1990, he decides it's time and he gets up and walks out to his pickup truck. He drives into town and parks in front of the florist shop and waits a minute. He walks in, says hello to the clerk at the counter, and fills out the order form for the floral arrangement with a ballpoint pen. He orders something nice that will last a while and that people can see from a ways off in a graveyard. How do you want the card to read, the clerk wants to know, and Dwight says, to Charlie Pyle, you're not forgotten and you never will be. He writes it on the card and pays for the order. The clerk picks up the phone and dials the florist in Colleyville, Texas, says a few pleasantries, and this ritual will play itself out year after year for 25 years. Always the same call, nearly the same banter between the florist on each end of the line, and then the clerk hangs up and says, will there be anything else, Dwight? And he says, no, I don't believe so. He leaves and gets up in his truck and drives back home, the oiled dirt roads, empty and rolling through the oak forests, his boyhood haunts, the Red Rock River, low, and forever running in the same direction, away from town. Dwight, on days like these, after posting the order for the flowers, wonders what would have happened to his life had he not gone to Vietnam. Had Charlie Pyle not been killed, would Charlie not dying have made any difference in his life? Which is like asking whether his life would have been different if there hadn't been so much sadness. What would have happened had he not gotten a job after the war working in factories, making batteries and shower cabinets and steel gears for diesel trains and earth movers? 33 years finally, walking on cement floors, lifting steel, breathing that same air. He wonders why he had to come home so angry at the world. He thinks about what would have happened if so many things had not happened, and he can't know if his life would have been better or worse. His life is what it is, right? The sum total of his experiences. Each year, the price of flowers creeps up, but who cares? He imagines the bouquet arranged carefully on Charlie's grave, imagines it sitting there in the sun and through the dark of night. He's on near total disability from the war, PTSD, bad back, insomnia, and he spends little of his money. After 9/11, there's little incentive to travel to see the world because these days you have to take your shoes off at the airport, and it just seems so much hassle to go anywhere. At night, the visions of Charlie and so many other things come back. Each time Dwight orders the flowers, he promises, I'm going to go to Texas someday, and I'm going to see Charlie's grave, and I'm going to bring the flowers myself. But he doesn't know if he'll have the courage. But in 2008, he decides it's finally time to visit. He finds the cemetery in Texas and walks the rows until he locates the simple marker placed there, a bronze plaque cemented into the ground. He remembers a young man who died so young that he can only recall a boy, 19 years old. Charlie Pyle, the sweet, handsome boy killed by the war, too young, and the world went on without him.
One of the things that I tell young writers who want to know about what it is to be a writer and what they are to do with themselves is I say to them, if you're going to write, you have to understand that you are a kind of a thief. and they don't quite understand what that means. And what I say to them is that if you are to write, you're going to have to be impolite, and you're going to have to ask questions that people don't want to answer, and you're going to have to go places by yourself and find out things that are otherwise hidden. And the thief part of it is that you actually are going to steal the gold of human truth from the people who have lived it. And you're going to take it, and you're going to work with it and make something of it. And by steal, I don't mean that you necessarily do it without their permission, but I mean that you are not, there's no license to do this, no one is approving that you do this, you just have to go do it. And the only requirement, I say to the young writers, is when you steal this gold, you have to give it back. You have to give it back to the reader. And I think that this is a wonderful example of the writer going and finding the gold in the moment, a quiet man ordering flowers in the middle of nowhere. And Doug, you've given back us the gold, the importance, the truth of what that's all about. So thank you.
Thank you.
And so now let's have some questions.
We have microphones in the audience, and if you would stand and say your name, and we'll do our best. Yes.
My name is Jack Siegel. I feel like I've just been hit by a piece of shrapnel when you read that piece about visiting, sending flowers to the grave. When I go to Los Angeles, which I do frequently, as you know, I visit the grave of Larry Stephan, and he and I went to OCS together at Fort Benning, and he arrived in Vietnam 3 weeks before me because I went to jump school and he didn't. And he was dead by the time I arrived. So what you've done is, I thought we might get tonight Ken Burns without the cool music, but what we really got was, instead of 50 million pictures and the entire supposed story, you have crystallized it down into one story, which applies to maybe 50,000 guys who were there. So for that, I thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Coming from Jack Siegel and Karen Pushel, that means a lot to me. We all know Jack Siegel in this community. If you don't know both of them, you should. Jack safely got me in and out of Afghanistan, later only to tell me that it was a lot more dangerous than he let on at the time. So I'm glad. Thank you, Jack. You're in charge. What should we do next?
I think we found a great place to stop, and that we should celebrate. And
so, thank you, everyone, for coming. This means a lot to me. I didn't know if this book would ever come out, but yet here it is. Thank you to Colin Harrison.
That was Doug Stanton talking with Colin Harrison. Doug Stanton's latest book is The Odyssey of Echo Company. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.